So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribes.
Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F-35A.
Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview.
To provide the most information to Wisconsin-Eye viewers and Wisconsin-Eye residents about the health emergency, Wisconsin-Eye is interviewing those on the front line of the health emergency. I'm so grateful that Attorney General Josh Call, who runs the State Department of Justice, is joining us today. General, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, I do want to talk about the effect of the health emergency on your agency. We'll get to that, but boy, you know, timeliness is an element of news, and there was a very interesting historic election yesterday, wasn't there?
Yeah, you know, it's really unfortunate that the election took place in the circumstances that it did. I supported Governor Evers' call to delay the in-person portion of that voting and to allow people to vote instead by mail. But, you know, unfortunately, that wasn't accepted by the courts. But it was incredible to see people, despite the challenges that they faced, show up to make sure that their voices were heard. And, you know, I'm glad that it's behind us now, and hopefully in the future, we won't ever have another election in circumstances anything like that.
Well, the lawsuit filed yesterday in federal court wants, according to the State Journal headline, a do-over. But do you think that the election results are legally defensible? Excuse me, General.
Yeah, I don't want to comment on details regarding an ongoing case, but what I will say is that certainly the votes that have been cast so far are valid votes. They're going to be counted. We're not going to try to, I don't think, undo anything that has already happened. Given the margins in most of the races, I think there's unlikely to be a lot that's disputed, but there were obviously some close races as well. So we'll see what happens in the courts, but you know, the circumstances of the election were certainly troubling. We had a public health emergency. The governor wanted to delay the election. We also had limited access to in-person voting in Milwaukee in particular. It's one of the reasons that having broad access to voting and lots of options is so important.
Well, in press conferences about a month out from the election, the governor had said, "I do not have the right to move this election." And then he did indeed try that, using health emergency. You read the Supreme Court opinion 4-2 that the governor cannot move an election. Do you agree with that 4-2 finding of the court, General?
Well, we accept the finding. I mean, that's what our Supreme Court found, and they're the ultimate authority on that question. You know, the statutes give the governor very broad authority during the course of a public health emergency to order lots of different steps to be taken. It's a limited authority. It only lasts for 60 days. You know, I would have liked to have seen that election move for public health purposes, but again, you know, we accept what the court decided, and ultimately what Governor Evers predicted is what the court found. You know, I know that he's talked about responding to the information as we get it, and this is a situation that is evolving quickly, and you know, I think he's been making judgments as the facts have developed, and so, you know, the timing at which this election took place was really bad from a public health standpoint, but unfortunately that's the timing that we had to work with.
So you agree with Supreme Court Justice, the future Supreme Court Justice Jill Karofsky, that the election should not have been held, General?
I think there should have been an extension so that there could have been full absentee voting for that election. I don't think anybody should have to put their health at risk so that they can vote in our election. And given how quickly the situation is developing, you know, I think a lot of folks didn't realize that they needed to get a request in as early as they needed to. You know, for the elections later on in August and in the fall, hopefully there we'll have much more time to prepare so that we don't have any shortages on absentee ballots and that people are able to get their requests in with plenty of time to make sure that their vote is counted.
Do we need to change any election laws between the August primary and the November general election? Or do you think by emphasizing the ability and right of voters to cast absentee ballots, we don't need to rewrite any election laws?
Well, I think the more that we can do to facilitate easy access to absentee voting, to allow people to register in ways that are easy. I think that's all a good thing here. And I know that there's been some legislative proposals that have been introduced already. But making sure that Wisconsinites are able to easily register to vote and to make sure that their vote is submitted and counted in the fall when we've got a critical presidential election, among other things in the ballot, I think is something that everybody should be able to get behind to make sure that we have an outcome that reflects the will of the voters.
What was your takeaway from the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the Wisconsin vote, sir?
Well, the district court allowed some additional time for absentee voters, and the Supreme Court pulled that back to some extent. It was an interesting decision. It imposed a deadline for when ballots are postmarked, which is not something that exists under Wisconsin law. So the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, imposed a rule that isn't a rule that's found in Wisconsin statutes, which was fairly unusual. But this is a new area. That was, I think, the first case to get to the U.S. Supreme Court relating to the coronavirus. It's certainly the first election case. And so I expect we're going to see more developments in the law in this area over the next several months as not only Wisconsin, but states around the country figure out how to modify their election systems so that we're able to have a fair and election that reflects the vote.
In press conferences yesterday, both the state and national Democratic Party chairs called for the May 12th special election of the 7th congressional district to be mail ballot only. Do you agree with that, General?
Well, ultimately, that's a decision for the governor to make. But what I think is critical is that when that decision is made, the governor looks at, from a public health standpoint, what kind of election should we have? It seems like we are making progress when it comes to flattening the curve and fighting coronavirus, but we don't want to lose that progress because we had an in-person election that then leads to an outbreak in coronavirus infection. So I think the governor's got to look at what public health experts are telling us and make a decision that corresponds with that.
In that same press conference, the chairs of the state and National Democratic Party accused the Republican legislators of, in their words, voter suppression. Do you agree with that term, General?
Well, clearly the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader were very intent on having this election move forward with in-person voting. They went to court to prevent the election from being delayed. I don't know what purpose that served. It resulted in having really long lines in Milwaukee where there were only 5 in-person voting locations. And it clearly was not in the best interest of public health to have people standing in line out in public when, generally speaking, we're under a safer at home order. So whatever their intent was in advocating to have the election go forward, it was certainly not in the best interest of this conference.
How widespread do you think voter disenfranchise was in the April 7 election because of absentee ballots that didn't arrive on time, were not returned on time? Democratic leaders' disenfranchisement was a major issue. Do you agree, sir?
Well, it's hard to quantify, but what I will say is that there have been reports that indicate that there were some real problems. One is the lines that we were just discussing. In Milwaukee, voters had to choose whether to wait in line for a long period of time and to put their health in danger or not vote in person. There have been reports of people who requested absentee ballots, but didn't receive them until it was too late to submit those ballots. And a few examples where the post office seems not to have delivered ballots that had been sent out. So there's no question that it had some impact on voters. And anytime you make it harder for people to vote, the natural outcome of that is going to be that fewer people ultimately turn out to vote. It was good to see the turnout was up in this election relative
yes.
to last year's spring election. But when, This is a warning sign for what's going to be coming in the fall. We're going to have far larger turnout in November than we had for this election. That means that there's going to be a lot more strain on the system. And if we're still dealing with a coronavirus emergency, we need to make sure that we have protocols in place and procedures that are going to make sure that every Wisconsinite who wants to cast a ballot and is eligible is able to do so.
Well, do you think that the election now, you mentioned the wide margins, and do you think then that the election, with all that went on, is still not defective in the eyes of a federal judge?
I think that we had litigation before this election took place, so that the terms under which this election took place were ones that were ones that were considered by the state Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. So courts weighed in on this in advance. And I think it's pretty clear, at least with the state Supreme Court election, with some other issues like the Marcy's Law, given the margins in those votes, it's clear that the result reflected the will of the voters. As I said, there were some other closer elections, and so I wouldn't be shocked if we see litigation relating to those. And if that happens, I think you will see, disputes over whether or not the number of voters that were impacted was enough that it impacted the outcome of the election. And we'll learn more about that as the facts develop and as these cases, if there are any, unfold.
Just two more questions on the election general, and then I promise to move on. If a voter believes that she or he contracted the virus in the process of voting, would there be any liability potentially for local or state governments, sir, do you think?
I think that's a legal question that would come up in a specific case. I wouldn't want to comment generally. But generally speaking, the government has facilities open. It's not only voting services. There are a lot of government services that are open. Government services have been deemed essential. And people have to make choices based on their own best judgment about what's in the interest of their safety. And I think it's unlikely that there'd be any liability for a government in that circumstance. But people shouldn't have to consider whether they might be putting their health at risk by going out to vote. We should make sure we have procedures in place that are going to make sure that people can have their ballot cast without worrying that their vote's not going to count, and yet can also take measures that are going to be safe for them and so that they know that their health is not going to be put.
So you're not yet at the point where you believe Wisconsin should go be like the state of Washington and have a all mail-in ballot, correct?
Well, I think we should make it so that any voter who wants to cast an absentee ballot and wants to register remotely is able to do that. I don't think there's any reason to say that they can't pursue other options unless there's a health concern in having people meet in person. But the more options that voters can use that are safe and secure, the better from my perspective.
I'm intrigued. The unofficial totals in the Supreme Court race, 1.5 million voters on April 7th. Last year, 1.2 million. 2 years ago, the April 18 election for the Supreme Court, 997,000. Why do you think so many more voters are choosing to vote in the Supreme Court election, sir?
It's always hard to say. There are a couple things that seem to have been driving the turnout. One is there was a presidential primary on the Democratic side. And if you remember back to the origins of the extraordinary session, after I was elected and Governor Evers was elected, the Republican legislators had talked about moving that spring election, in part because, I think they were worried the turnout was going to be high for the Democratic presidential primary, and that seems to be, to some extent, what happened in this recent election. The other thing was, there was a lot of attention on this election because of the circumstances in which it was taking place, and there was a sense, as you referred to earlier, that there was an effort to suppress people's votes. And I think that when you see that kind of attention and when people are worried that their rights are under attack, you do see a large turnout. And I think there was some effect in that. So the combination of all the attention that this election got, not only here but nationally, and then the presidential primary, I think led to this increase in turnout.
I assume you and your wife voted absentee, sir?
That is correct, yes.
I understand. Okay, let's move on. How has a health emergency affected your Department of Justice, General?
Well, like any large organization, our department has had to make a lot of adjustments to the way that it operates to make sure that we are using safe social distancing practices. So the majority of our employees, including myself, are now working remotely. We have some functions that can't be conducted remotely. As an example, we've got criminal investigators in our Division of Criminal Investigations who, sometimes have to go out as part of their job. We have crime lab staff who have to go into the office sometimes to do their work. But even there, we've made accommodations. So we've provided masks to employees who have to go into the office. We've told people that they should wear those when they're in spaces that are commonly used by others. Our crime labs have set up staggered shifts to minimize the number of people who are in the office at any time. So like a lot of organizations, we've been making changes. The other thing we've been doing is working with especially law enforcement agencies around the state as they work to adjust to this. There are a lot of challenges presented to law enforcement by the need to socially distance, and agencies around Wisconsin have been working to make sure they're both protecting public safety, but also adopting practices that are helpful to public health, so they're not they don't become vectors for transmitting coronavirus.
The governor has said he's asked his cabinet and you as a constitutional officer, what additional resources you need in this time of health emergency? How has DOJ responded? What more does DOJ need, sir?
Well, there are a few areas where we've really stepped up what we're doing in response to the coronavirus. One is, you know, we have an Office of Open Government that regularly provides advice to government agencies and the public about open records issues. But with the need for social distancing, there's been increased interest in how local governmental bodies can conduct their business in a way that's safe, but also that is transparent to the public. So we've issued some guidance on that front. We've also put out some advisories about the importance of consumers practicing precaution when they are doing things like contributing to charities. Important to know who they're contributing to so it's not a scam charity. Also when they're responding to emails or text messages, making sure that they are legitimate and not fraudulent scam emails. So we are engaged in those consumer protection efforts. And then we're assisting, as I said, law enforcement. We've been advocating for more personal protective equipment for not only for healthcare providers, but also for first responders. And as agencies around the state, as I said, respond to the challenges they're facing, we've been playing a consulting role there as well. Our hope is that the impact on us from a budgetary standpoint won't be significant, but a lot of that remains to be seen and will depend in part on how our work shifts in response to what's been going on around the state.
Do we have enough safeguards in our open in our open government laws in this era of virtual government? The Assembly and Senate are going to hold their first virtual sessions. How can taxpayers Wisconsin has had a tradition of open and transparent state and local governments. Are you worried that our tradition of open and transparent is going to be hurt as more and more state and local governments have to go to the virtual online meeting, sir?
I'm hopeful that it won't. And in some ways, actually, I think that this might lead to some better practices in the long run with respect to open government. One of the things that we've stressed in the guidance that we've issued is you can hold a meeting remotely and yet still have good public access to the meeting as long as you've done things like given the public the dial-in information for the teleconference, making sure that if it's a video conference, that the public has a way to access the video. In fact, people can then monitor those meetings from their home without having to go to a government building to personally observe the meetings. So in that way, it can even act to increase access. But it's also important as government agencies and local governments take those steps, that they're mindful about the fact that not everybody has equal access to technology. So making sure that there's a telephone dial-in option if you're doing a video is important for people who might not have internet access. But making sure you're providing accommodation to people with disabilities who may not be able to access the meeting in the same way. And then providing reasonable accommodations to people on an individual basis. All of those steps are important to make sure that our meetings are as transparent as possible.
Okay, but just to follow up, there are, you and I are well aware of the broadband deserts in rural areas of Wisconsin. How can those people follow, hold their local governments open and transparent?
That's one of the reasons it's really important to have a call-in option so that if people don't have internet access, they can hear the meeting. Other agencies may look at it if there's a problem even with telephone access and people want to observe the meetings, figuring out a way to set something up so that there's a publicly accessible way, whether it's at a government building or somewhere else where they can broadcast things. Again, they need to do that in a way that's safe and that's consistent with social distancing requirements. But there are a lot of creative steps that that local government agencies can take to make sure that access is not impaired. The key is for them to be thinking about it. And the good news is, I think that local governments around the state are thinking about it, are being both careful to make sure they're protecting health, but also maintaining transparency.
Okay, a couple more questions on the health emergency. Is DOJ seeing more scams and more overpricing of commodities as simple as toilet paper?
There has certainly been concerns about that, and there are price gouging protections in place right now because of the public health emergency. The complaints in the first instance go to VATCAP, and so they're the better agency to sort of quantify that. We have seen, I think they talked about VATCAP sending out 16 cease and desist letters, and certainly around the country, we have seen a number of scams that relate to the coronavirus. That's what you expect to see in these situations, unfortunately, which is that scammers they like to take advantage of people's uncertainty and crisis situations. And so when these things happen, it's important for consumers to be vigilant. We put out guidance specifically because we want to help people protect themselves. But if they do have concerns, it's important that they report them to VATCAP if it's a consumer protection or price gouging issue. And if it's a fake charity issue, to the Department of Financial Institutions.
The governor's safer at home order, differentiated between essential and non-essential entities. Has DOJ offered advice on which businesses are essential and non-essential, sir?
So the governor's office has the authority to issue those orders. What we have done is worked with both the governor's office and with local law enforcement agencies around the state to identify issues that have arisen when it comes to the enforcement of that order and other issues relating to the emergency declaration. And we've sort of facilitated communications. I am hopeful that there's going to be a sort of more formal process that WEDC sets up for local law enforcement, which ultimately, they're ultimately responsible for enforcing the terms of the order. But that's what our role has been, to help identify issues and to help facilitate communication so that we are all working together and that the way that the law is being enforced in Waukesha is consistent with the way it's being enforced in Bayfield, so that the same types of companies are treated consistently. We're also just making sure that there's been general compliance with this order, because it's critical that people socially distance so that we can fight the coronavirus. There generally has been, I think, very good compliance. Wisconsinites understand that there is a critical threat to public health right now. And it looks like, from the data we've seen so far, that the curve really is flattening. But we can't let up. We need to make sure that we are continuing to stamp this out so that it gets to as low a level as possible, so that when we reopen, we are able to do so without having a lot of false starts, and we can really go back to living life as normally as possible.
But it's spring and we're getting restless, safer at home. Do you look for more law enforcement agencies to stop and ask people, why are you out, given the safer at home order? And how widespread have those stops been in the past, sir?
The approach that law enforcement agencies seem to be taking around the state, and I think it's the right one, is to start out with education and make people aware of what the terms of the order are and why it's critical that people comply with them. And that's, I think, an important part not to lose here. There is the legal piece of this, but ultimately, the reason people need to stay at home is because if they don't, if they are interacting with others, that risks further transmission of the coronavirus, which means not only that they could become ill, but they could infect others, and that then has a domino effect. So to keep Wisconsinites safe, it's critical that people practice social distancing.
To your knowledge.
Following up on that, if people are not compliantly refused to follow the orders, is sort of the next step.
To your knowledge, has anybody been charged with violating the safer at home order, General?
I don't know if there have been any charges brought. I know that there have been cease and desist letters that have been issued, and I know that there are cases where, and this is what I think has happened a lot, is law enforcement contacts people, informs them of the law, and if they believe there's a violation, they inform people of that. And by and large, people, when they are aware of that, comply with it and take the appropriate steps. But if there is willful non-compliance, people just refuse to accept the order, I do think they'll see charges. And we've seen some indications now in Milwaukee and Fond du Lac, in Madison, and we see some desist letters issued where they're getting to the point now where people don't comply. I think we will see charges.
President Trump yesterday said he alone will determine when the nation's economy will reopen. At his press conference yesterday, Governor Evers said, "I disagree with that interpretation." Are you, as DOJ, doing research on the authority of governors vis-a-vis the federal powers in terms of when Wisconsin's economy might reopen?
Well, that's not a difficult legal question. I mean, the states have the authority to declare their own public health emergencies. The federal government can't tell the states that no, they don't have a public health emergency and they need to undeclare one. And frankly, what we saw as we've responded to this public health crisis is the states taking the lead. It's not the federal government that declared an emergency that caused Wisconsin or Wisconsinites to stay safe at home. They did eventually declare a federal emergency, but it's Governor Evers who issued the safer at home order. We do need the federal government to step up and play a role in assisting with critical supplies, personal protective equipment, supplies for medical facilities like ventilators, and making sure that they have capacity to treat all of the people who come into hospitals around the state. And then we need more tests, and that requires more of the reagents that are used for those tests. So the federal government does have a big role to play, but it can't tell states that they can't issue emergency orders. And also, you know, Wisconsinites are rightly concerned right now about not socially distancing because it would be harmful to public health. And, you know, regardless of what the president says, I think that until we really reduce the transmission rate, we're not going to see people engaging in economic activities and other activities the same way they were before the virus started to spread. That's why it's so critical that we get these transmission rates as low as possible and then reopen so that we can fully reopen as an economy and as a society.
Well, final question on the health emergency. What issues, what concerns are you going to be watching as this plays out over the next 4 weeks, 6 weeks, or 8 weeks, General?
Well, first, we've got to continue to flatten the curve. And so watching the number of new cases is really important. But also, we need to make sure that we are getting good data about what's happening. And that requires a significant increase in testing because, you know, while we are able to get a sense of the trends in the data we have, we still don't really know exactly how widespread it is because it's just a fraction of people getting tested who ultimately could. So what I'm hoping we will see is much more testing so that we're able to have a more specific, localized response. If testing indicates that there might be community spread going on in a particular city, then that city can take precautions that may be different from the precautions that another city takes. So seeing an increase in that test is something that I'm really hoping we will see and we'll be watching closely. And then last, monitoring hospital capacity. It's critical that we keep ICU beds and ventilators and medical professional availability at a greater level than the number of cases. Because as awful as this virus is, when folks have it and there's insufficient medical capacity, that's when we can see even more devastating results. So making sure that we have kind of supplies there and for our first responders that we need is another thing that we're going to keep watching closely.
Following up on something you said earlier, as you stagger the work shifts at the crime lab, is this eventually going to create a backlog and evidence that needs to be tested for our criminal justice system?
I think the answer is no. Unfortunately, our crime lab staff have been really creative. There was a brief drop in submission to the crime lab when some of these social distancing policies began going into effect, but our crime lab has had pretty steady work since then. And they've been taking innovative measures to make sure that that doesn't happen, but it's something we're going to monitor. And if it does lead to a need for more resources or for a change in protocols, that's something we're going to stay closely on top of because we can't let cases get backed up because that delays justice if we're not getting tests completed on a timely basis.
And then final question, not on the health emergency, but a press release I think DOJ issued yesterday. You joined with other attorney generals against the having guns printed on guns printed by what's the actual term? The
3D printed
firearms. 3D printers. Is there any 3D printers in Wisconsin being used to manufacture guns?
Well, that's one of the reasons that this is so important. The answer is we don't know, because 3D printers can be used with the right blueprints for this technology to print firearms. And what's going on here is that there's a person who describes himself as a crypto anarchist who wants to have 3D firearms printed as far and wide as possible. And the reason that's so dangerous, one of the reasons, is there are no serial numbers on these firearms, so they're not traceable. There's also obviously no background check conducted, which means that somebody who is ineligible to purchase a firearm can do so. And these guns can't be detected by traditional metal detectors, which means that the security measures that we have in place in places like airports or at sporting events wouldn't stop somebody from bringing one of these weapons into those events. So we are taking action with a number of other AGs to try to stop those blueprints from being distributed, because it's bad for public safety in Wisconsin and around the country.
Well, I really appreciate the number of subjects that we've addressed and all the time you've taken. Attorney General Josh Call, thanks so much for this update, and you and your family stay safe, sir.
And to you, Stephen, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civics broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.